Two.
Okay, thank you. All right. Well, thank you for a wonderful lunch and great getting to know many of you better. The plan for the second session today is to have a little bit of an overview and survey of some of the pressing halachic, medical, ethics, cutting-edge issues that we're facing right now around the country and around the world. So we'll talk a little bit about physician aid in dying, or medical aid in dying in some places it's called, because it's now legal in a number of states. It's becoming increasingly legalized, and so it's worth talking about also because some of the approaches are just very relevant and valid and important to be aware of. We'll talk about a little bit about some issues that are coming up right now in Israel, some interesting medical halachic issues that I think are also relevant, interesting, and important to be aware of, and then also some of the more futuristic issues that are coming, but they're coming like really soon, like next month. So like really coming around the corner. So that we'll just talk about a little bit. I wasn't exaggerating, but you'll see what I mean. So the first one, and I guess I'll pass out the papers now. I apologize, I didn't translate anything on these, but we'll translate as we go, but we're not going to look at all of it. But the first one I want to talk about with you is medical aid in dying. This is, and I'll tell you how the legislation works first, but maybe first I'll tell you some stories, just to get started with stories and background, and then I'll go more in depth. Physician aid in dying became legal in California in June 2016. We had our first request in May 15th, 2016, 15 days before it became legal. Anyone want to guess why we already got a request 15 days before it became legal?
The law was
that a person had to request it once, and then they had to request again 15 days later, and only then could they receive the medication. So some people were so anxious to do it that they actually requested it ahead of time. We had people who the law is also that one has to be terminal, which they define as having 6 months or less to live. There were people that stopped taking diabetes and other medications in order to become terminal so that they could then utilize that, which is interesting. We had a patient who had an aggressive surgery in order to prolong their life long enough that they could survive the 2 weeks in order to get to the second request.
Wow.
Which is like counterintuitive, right? Because if they were going to die anyways, why did they? So we'll talk about that also. We had a patient who asked me, he asked to see the rabbi. When I went in, he says, "Rabbi, what's the best day of the week for a funeral? Like halakhically, Jewishly, what's the best day of the week for a funeral?" So I said, "Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there's a day that's the best day. We just do them right away as soon as we can." "Why do you ask?" He said, "Well, because I'm planning on ending my life, and I want to have the funeral the next day, and so I want to die on the day that's the day before the best day for a funeral." I was like, "You have other questions that you should be other questions to ask." A little ahead, we had it. I'm just giving you examples of like some of the wild questions that we were not anticipating. Like, you know, this it became legal, and all of a sudden you're getting these questions that are just like, we had someone. I'm going to change some minor details to de-identify. I've been doing that with all the stories, but just to make it clear that that's what I've been doing. We had someone, a doctor, who came to our bioethics committee with the following dilemma. So, as I said, it's not only that it has to be two requests. 2 weeks apart, 15 days apart, it has to be two separate doctors. When it first became legal, we had someone who approached us and said, he is a liver cancer specialist. And there was someone who, I don't think she even had citizenship, an immigrant woman who was living in Los Angeles, but she didn't even speak English. And she went to her doctor, she had liver cancer. Her doctor said, you know, this is not treatable. I don't see any way of curing this, but there is an option now in California if you don't want to go through all the pain and suffering that you can and your life on your own faster. So she said, okay, that sounds better. So he said, okay, I have to send you to another doctor, though, because the way it works is that I have to have someone else sign off on it. So he sent her to this doctor, but this doctor he sent her to is a specialist in that type, specific type of cancer. He's also a very expensive specialist, very top of his field. And he, when he examined this patient, he said he realized he could treat her. He wouldn't call her terminal, but treating her would be extremely expensive. She didn't have insurance or anything. And he now felt, am I required to treat her, or should I just sign off on this? Because to that doctor, she is terminal, meaning he has no treatment for her, but I do have a treatment for her. So what am I supposed to do? That would be great. But it was easier said than done, I guess. He didn't want her. But I mean, just giving you some sampling of like some of the challenging questions. And then what we had was initially it was called the End of Life Options Act in California. And not only, and this is how it works, especially in Canada, especially strongly, is that not only is one is this an option, but one is expected to make an effective referral, to actually suggest it, that this is one of one's options, not just that it's there, but that one should be suggesting it. So many of our Jewish doctors, I'm sure in other religions as well, but in our community, many people are asking, am I allowed to give a referral to something that's legal, but I'm not comfortable with halachically or emotionally or theologically? So these are some of the big questions. I'm sharing these, and I'll share our approaches then, but then I'm going to get to one that we did not even anticipate, but then all of a sudden smacked us, and I had to research a little bit. That's why I'm going to share with you my research on it, and before we go on to the next topic. But so first of all, as I mentioned, the law is two referrals, 15 days apart, terminal patient, and they have to self-ingest, which is, by the way, this is a big controversy right now, the self-ingesting part, because, you know, in Canada, they call it MAID there, medical aid in dying. In Canada, it's technically euthanasia. Mm-hmm. Canada, there are people who actually administer it for the patient. So not necessarily the doctors, but there's people who their job is to do it. And so you could call that killing them. I mean, it depends on how you want to look at it. In America, in all the places, I think it's 12 states right now, but it's growing. Everywhere it's legal in America, it has to be self-ingested. The patient receives the prescription. Yeah, so this is the debate. This is the big controversy right now. Now go to your...
Sorry, not to jump ahead.
No, you're right. What?
How does this jive with the Hippocratic Oath?
Well, that was what a lot of physicians aren't happy about, it because they feel like they became doctors to heal, not to end lives. But others, doctors argue that, you know, they're helping people to deal with their pain, and so they feel that that's beneficial. There's only a limited number of doctors who do it. In most places, not every majority won't do it, but some do. Usually they're palliative care or hospice physicians. Actually, that's become the rule. Almost every single one in California, 98% are enrolled in hospice when they do this. So there was this big debate. It's happening right now. It's raging in the medical ethics literature. A big fight over the fact that, on the one hand, the American rule is more cautious, you could say, because it has to be self-ingested. That's to avoid slippery slopes of, you know, it's very risky. I mean, just to take a quick step, side point for a minute, even though it became legal in California in 2016, and it's not legal here right now, it doesn't mean it doesn't happen in other ways. I remember being in a patient's room once. I'm again changing minor details, but it was a VIP patient who was dying very slowly. In halacha, we call it mishahu goseis zman aruch, but I'm sure you've dealt with this many times, where patients dying very slowly, right? They take a long time to die, and that could be traumatic for the family. When they've kind of said their goodbyes, expecting the person to die, and they seem to be suffering, and they don't like it. So we had said vidui like the day before with this patient, and I happened to be in the room when they were commenting on how they felt it was inhumane that their loved one was still dying and still like kind of breathing difficultly, and they felt suffering. So at one point, the palliative care physician came in. I mean, I'm changing slightly even specialties, just so I don't want to be careful about how I'm talking, but this physician came in, and they said, isn't it inhumane that the patient's still alive? I mean, it's really bothering us, and it's like, isn't there anything that you can do? And the physician was like, I don't know. And then the physician went to give some narcotic pain medication to the patient. As he was preparing to give it, the family said, that just seemed like enough. You know, come on, you know what, you know, like wink, wink. So he went out, increased the dose, came back, he did it, and then the patient died within like a minute. To me, it was very clear what had happened, that he overdosed the patient. But, I mean, no one said anything, and I was like, okay, I guess this really is happening. I mean, I remember a time, I'm just sharing these stories because these are also relevant for Illinois because it's not legal here, but I remember a time when I got called to a patient, and I was told there's an end-of-life patient wants to see the rabbi for end-of-life issues. That's all I was told. I walk in the room, the patient's sitting in a chair, eating lunch, watching TV, and like laughing. So I was like, I'm not going to walk in and say like, oh, but I mean, I thought you're dying. So I was just like, hi, nice to meet you. Ask open-ended questions. Tell me what's going on. And nothing came up. So I was like, okay, must be it was the wrong room. That's the only solution I could think of. So I was like, okay, we had a nice visit. I really tried to probe and say, like, tell me what's going on for you. Are there ways that I could be helpful? I was trying to really ask questions and she didn't say anything. So I was just like, I'm confused. I walked out of the room. I see the nurse. I remember it was a very conscientious, very religious Christian nurse. And I walked in and she says, oh, Rabbi, I'm glad you came. I put in the referral for you to go. I was like, okay. I thought the patient was dying. She's like, she didn't tell you what's happening? I said, uh-oh. She's like, are you okay with what's happening in there? I was like, wait, I'm totally confused. She says, Rabbi, I believe it's called euthanasia. I was like, what do you mean? That's illegal. She goes, oh, you're so naive. I was like, what do you mean? She was like, she's colluding with her staff, her medical team. Basically, they exaggerate the level of pain she's in, and then she engages in something called voluntarily stopping eating and drinking, VSED. And the doctors kind of overdose her as she also stops eating, and she dies. And the doctor's like, this happens all the time. That's why I put in the referral, so you could tell her not to do it. But she didn't ask me about it, and it was a very awkward situation to be in. I was like, oh, I have a message from your nurse. I actually called a hospice chaplain, rabbi, at that time, because I was so shocked. I was like, you'll never believe what I just heard and what I just saw. I told the story, and he starts laughing. I was like, why are you laughing at me? I'm really traumatized by this. He was like, Maisin b'chol yom. This happens every day. I see this all the time. So, I don't know. I'm just saying, even though it's legal in California, it might be more common than we know.
So, Rabbi Dunzel, okay.
Yeah.
I want to know if, in the case of power of attorney for healthcare, how it works in this case. We were talking about this person whose parent and ended up getting more medicine and dying and stuff. A parent can't request this for their person that they're power of attorney for in any way. It has to be the person themselves
in sound mind who actually makes that decision.
Yes, 100%. They have to do. They have to choose themselves. So here's the big controversy that's swirling right now. The big controversy right now is in Canada. You see, they allow the technician to do it for the patient. In America, they don't. The patient has to self-ingest. But there are some patients, like for example, ALS patients who lose use of their hands. There's people who aren't able to swallow. Usually it's a disability concern that not everyone's able to do this. So disability rights activists in America have argued that it should be broadened. In fact, we once had a speaker from Canada in our hospital to talk about this, and I guess she knew it was for a Jewish hospital. She goes, yeah, in Canada, our laws are really pikuach nefesh. Like, pikuach nefesh for euthanasia? What do you mean? She goes, in Canada, a patient can wait till the very end and just tell the doctor, if you think I'm suffering, you do it. Whereas in America, since the patient has to do it themselves, if they see that they're on a downward, you know, they're declining, they don't want to wait too long because they're afraid they're going to lose use of their hands, so they do it sooner. So it actually prolongs life by having euthanasia. If it's, you know, so that's a big debate in America right now, because one of the big concerns is the slippery slope concern, which is that once it's allowed, you know, because in Canada, you don't have to be terminal. You have to, the law is, you have to have a reasonable likelihood of dying at some point. That's the way it's worded. I know, we laugh too when they told us about that, because everyone has that. But there, it doesn't, you know, not have to be terminated, you know. So they tried to change the wording a little bit, but it could really be abused, that, right? Some, I mean, there was some story in the Netherlands about someone who lost a beauty pageant or something. And I mean, there, and even it's for minors. So it could, there's really concerns about slippery slope. In California, it became, when it became legal, there was a 2-week waiting period. So as a rabbi, part of my role, and I'll talk about chaplaincy in a middle, little bit, our role as chaplains in this, and then also halachic issues. Oftentimes, obviously, many Jewish families were, in my experience, many have done it. Many, I've had many patients who have done it. We've had many who asked the chaplain to try to convince someone not to, which is a difficult role for a chaplain. But it has to be done in a very careful and cautious and compassionate way. So it wasn't that hard, though, because there's that 2-week waiting period. Not everyone wants to wait that long. And it also gives you time to talk to someone. And as I mentioned before, we found that when someone has someone to talk to, that they actually oftentimes choose not to do it. And in fact, the research found, anyone want to guess what do you think the most common reason patients do this is?
Loneliness.
That's what? Say what you said?
Has to be a burden on the family.
They don't want to be a burden on the family. Good.
Depression,
finance. These are all good answers, but there's one reason that's the number one reason of all the reasons that we did not expect. Control. They want to have control over their dying process, where they die, how they die, when they die. They feel that when they have a terminal illness and so much is being done to them, that they lose a sense of control over what's happening, and that control is also very challenging for many people, and this gives them control. That's why so many people, once they get the prescription, end up not doing it, because they feel like they have control now, and they don't need to do it, they have their control back. And oftentimes, that's why the intervention is to help talk to them, listen to them, help them feel a sense of understanding of what they're going through, that we relate to them and hear them, and that they feel like they're in control of what's happening, when's happening, why is it happening. In fact, there was a study in Oregon, I mentioned to you this morning, the study that found that doctors, the more time they spend listening, the less likely the patients were to do it. There was another study, which is fascinating. I'm happy to send that. I don't have it with me, but I'm happy to send it out if you want, because I think it's one of the most important studies to me as a chaplain. It's, they ask people, they ask, in Oregon, they ask a lot of questions. There's a lot of surveys they fill out. In California too, but not as much as Oregon. And whenever someone chooses to do this, they have questions, when they, and they constantly ask them, you know, they ask follow-up questions. So they want to understand people who don't do it. Meaning they get the prescription, they qualified, but then they don't do it. They want to understand why not. And they found something, one of the things that they found so fascinating about religious clergy, they ask people, do you have religious clergy that you talk to, whether that's chaplain or any? And you know, they found a certain percentage said yes. Then they asked them, the one question they ask about their clergy is your clergy compassionate and supportive of you as an individual despite what you're doing, or in light of what you're doing, or have they been judgmental, negative, and you know, off-putting because of your decision? Fascinatingly, those who said that their clergy was supportive and compassionate were less likely to do it. By having someone listen to them with compassion, and it's a very fine line, especially if you believe that it's halakhically prohibited, how do you provide compassion and support without giving your stamp of approval? But it is possible to do that, to listen, to not to be judgmental, to show that you understand their pain. It's possible to understand someone's pain, even if you don't agree with what they're doing, that you understand why they would choose that. I mean, it's sort of like, there is a halacha, there's an interesting halacha. I mentioned Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach this morning. He has a fascinating psak that gets quoted a lot, which is that sometimes it's allowed by halacha to pray for someone to die. We know this is in the Talmud many times, like Rabbi Yehuda Nasi when he was dying, and many other stories. When someone's dying, you're allowed, in certain cases, they're suffering, to pray for them to die. You can't kill them, but you can pray for them to die. The poskim say, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, other great rabbis say, even for a patient who's suffering and dying, for whom it would be allowed to pray for them to die, if something happens to them on Shabbat, such that you would need to rush them to the hospital, you can break Shabbos, to break them into the hospital, even while you're praying for them to die. I mean, it's sort of like a back, like, wait, How can I break Shabbos and save their life if I want them to die because I know they're suffering so much? But if that's what they need right now, you could do it. So I see how you can have a bifurcated, like we say in Gemara, Palgina Diburo. You can split your mind and kind of think two things at once. I support you, I'm with you, and I don't want you to do this. But I'm with you. It's a complicated balance. But yeah.
He's muted now.
Let's wait. Okay.
We'll get to it.
Okay. So anyways, that's another one of the issues. So these are all things that are being debated. So one of the questions then becomes related to this question is the doctors. The doctors who are being asked are told that they have to give referrals for all the person's options, and can they do this? If someone feels that this is wrong, are they allowed to give a referral? And especially in light of what I just said about the importance of the doctor listening, showing compassion, and being there for the person. So we all thought our doctors were getting really nervous when this became legal, because what is going to happen if it's required? They slightly modified the law, but what if it's required to make a referral, but I don't want to make that referral? So we brought out to our hospital Rav Usher Weiss, who is the rabbi, the posek of Shaar Tzedek Medical Center in Yerushalayim, and I consider to be a very important rabbinic thinker today, and I'm going to talk about him a little bit more later. And we asked him if he would address this, because he felt like he has big enough shoulders. He's considered to be one of the leading rabbinic authorities in the world today. And I had no idea what he would say. We were just wanted to hear guidance. And he said, very interestingly, almost shockingly, not only do I think you can make a referral, I think you should make a referral. Which was, okay, what does that mean? I'll explain. Because he wasn't encouraging people to engage in this. He wasn't saying you should go about making referrals, but you should be seeing the patients for whom you'll be asked to make a referral. What does it mean? He said, first of all, I believe it's important to have religious, Jewish, conscientious people who can relate to their patients working in healthcare. If you take an approach that says you cannot be involved with anything that might be controversial in any way in healthcare, then anyone who can relate to their patients is going to just say, I'm sorry, I can't do it. I can't have the job. I can't work there. I can't work in this field. So, and what's going to happen to healthcare? It's important to have people, you know, moral diversity, people from different perspectives, people that can relate to their patients. So it's important to have this flexibility. Now, there is an issue in halacha called lifnei iver. You can't put a stumbling block before the blind. That's the category of you can't help someone engage in something that's prohibited by Jewish law. But the reality is that lifnei iver, we have something called trei avrei denahara, two sides of the river. The example that, it's actually fitting where we are, the example that the Gemara gives is like a nuzer who says, I won't drink wine. Or imagine someone who can't have alcohol. If they ask you, oh, could you just pass me that cup of wine? But if you say no, I'll just get it myself. It's right there. You're right next to me. But if you're on the other side of the river and I don't have a boat, and I say, hey, can you find a way to get me that wine? I have no way to get it myself. Then you can't bring it to me. But if I could get it anyways myself, so then it's much less prohibited, especially if it's not at the time that I'm doing it, and I could do it anyways, and there's, you know. So he felt it's not really lifnei iver. So the fact that you're involved now, when they ask, patients might ask their doctor, I'm thinking about this, what do you think? So now if you have a doctor who's concerned about it, and you're asking that doctor, what do you think? So they will be a little bit more nuanced and give you more options. Whereas if you only allow doctors to work in the field that are advocates, there might be subtle pressure. So he said, I think you should be working in this field. You should be involved with these patients because you have a chance to have real, honest conversations. It's sort of like when I started working at the hospital, and this is another issue that I'm sure you can relate to. One of the first issues that I started to realize is a big issue, a common issue. I know many chaplains have dealt with this. I've heard Rabbi Ozarowski speak about this. Is what about terminal extubation in cases in which it would be problematic by Jewish law or a person's own morals? What about when you get this call, which is a very common call, chaplain, rabbi, what time can you come? Because the family wants to do terminal extubation, and the respiratory therapist needs to know what time you're going to come, because they'll come right after, or they'll schedule it all based on your schedule. So if you can come at 2, the patient's going to die at 2:05. You know? So can you go to that? I mean, they're saying to you, when you show up, the patient dies. Can you go? Or if you can go, do you have to say, well, okay, you know, I'm going to wait till right before I leave tonight. I'll at least let them live 4 hours longer. So this is a big question. A lot of rabbis say you can't. Rabbis that I spoke to, one rabbi told me the story of the Brisker Rav. The Brisker Rav was the rabbi of a town. A Jew got captured and put in jail and was going to be sentenced with the death penalty. And they gave him one last wish. His last wish, this is a really good Jew. His last wish was he wants a blessing from his rabbi. He wants his rabbi to come. So they come to the Brisker Rav in shul one day and they say, Rabbi, your congregant's on death row. He's about to die, but he wants you, before he dies, his last wish is for you to go bless him. So the rabbi says, okay, I'll be there soon. And then they leave. They come back like hours later, like, Rabbi, we're waiting for you. So, okay, yeah, I'll be there soon. They leave again. They come back. He's not there. The next day, they come back. Rabbi, what's going on? So, oh yeah, I'm sorry. I'll be there soon. Saying he plays games with them and he wouldn't go. Eventually, they killed the person anyways without the rabbi coming. It's the end of the story, unfortunately. But they say from that story, you see, you shouldn't go. So one rabbi told me, you can't go to these patients. You send a non-Jewish chaplain, and you can't be there. But when I asked Rav Asher Weiss, and this helps explain the previous ruling so you understand, he said, can you go? You should go. He said, what do you mean? The families there need a rabbi. These are oftentimes families that don't have a rabbi. They never ask a rabbi question. You going doesn't mean you're saying it's okay. It means you're saying, I'm here with you. And you're in a hard time, and I'm here for you. And he said, and you know what? Out of 1,000 times, every now and then, maybe they'll ask you, and you'll talk about it. Or let's say they don't change their mind, but let's say they're planning on cremating the patient, because this is also common. And they'll ask you gently, because what I have a lot, I'm sure you all deal with this in California, it's already 60% of Jewish patients get cremated. So oftentimes, we're very careful to be non-judgmental, and of course, it's important. Sometimes they'll say to me something like, Rabbi, we're cremating, I hope that's okay. And obviously I'm not going to say, yes, it's okay. But I'll say something like, well, why, tell me about why you chose that. And oftentimes I'll say, well, it's just so much cheaper. So then I do feel comfortable saying, oh, do you know, you do what you've decided, but we do have a program here that we have an organization, we will pay for the whole burial. If you'll choose traditional burial instead of cremation, it's actually all paid for. I can take care of it for you. You don't have to do anything. And oftentimes they'll say, oh, okay, sure, that's great. So he was saying, so if you can go be there for this terminal extubation, even though you might have thought, I can't go because that's looking like I approve of it, but look what you did. You accomplished that. They were going to do it anyways, so you didn't solve anything by not going, and you helped them. They said the prayers, they stopped the cremation. Like, there are other ways in which, so he said, it's beneficial. So he told these doctors, he said, You should be there with these patients. You're not going to be saying that you encourage this or that you're an advocate, but it's important for you to be involved. And if they choose that, people have the right to choose that if that's legal. So it's a very complicated tightrope to walk on, but it was an important one. The issue is a lot of it. The slippery slope is real. So I mentioned to you about the 15-day waiting period. So last year, first of all, 2 years ago in Oregon, I'm building up to something. While we talk to these patients and we show them that respect, having the 15 days is also helpful because oftentimes it takes time to build rapport with people and to get to know them. And also 15 days is a little bit of a tircha. It's a little bit like, I have to wait 15 days. I was like, why do I need to bother with like this whole process? It's so cumbersome. And that was intentional. When they wrote that into the law, they said, if people want it, they could do it. But let them at least have to work for it a little bit so it shouldn't be too like, because you don't want doctors to just kind of push us on people, especially like the case I told you about. It's so sad. This woman could be treated by a doctor. She could have her life saved. If she would have known that, she wouldn't have chosen it. So if it's too easy to engage in this, it's also not good. So, and I had many experiences where people said, I talked to people and part of it was they said, you know, it's such a pain in the neck. I'm not going to do it. This year, they changed it in California following Oregon, and I think it's going to happen around the country, from 15 days to 2 days. And also, look at the chart I passed around. Look at the numbers, the way it's increasing. We had that first year, it was only 292 prescriptions, 151 people that actually died. That was because it was only 6 months. It was only half a year, as I told you, started in June. The second full year went up to 614, basically stayed the same the next year. Slight increase in 2019, slight increase 2020, very slight in 2021. 2022, shot up. And okay, we're watching it closely. We analyze the data very carefully. We've had patients in our hospital who've done this. We're analyzing it carefully because if it goes back down next year, okay, that was a blip. But if it continues to shoot up like that, it's definitely concerning. I mean, we have to wonder if our people engaging in this, is there pressure? Are people doing this too quickly? Because in Canada, there's been a lot of articles very recently about how people are concerned that it has increased exponentially. It's a significant percentage of all deaths in Canada now. So that could be a challenge. But here's a halachic issue that then arose with all this increasing that we weren't expecting. So I had a number of patients that I worked with that did this, and many who didn't, who got the prescription but didn't do it. A while back...
Do they pay a lot for this prescription?
No, not a lot at all. A while back, I had a patient who was an Orthodox Jew who did this, who wanted it. And I was surprised. And I actually had a couple Orthodox Jews who done this, and his family was furious and trying to ask me, can you convince him? We're trying to convince him. We have to try everything we can. And, you know, I was very gentle. They weren't as gentle, but we were just like, you know, trying to make sure he understood what he was doing. Do you understand the prohibition in Jewish law? He said, I don't care. I don't care that it's prohibited. They said, but don't you follow Jewish law? He says, yes, I follow all Jewish law. So what about this? You don't understand how hard it is to be me right now, what I'm going through. And even though it's prohibited, I don't care. I'm doing it anyways. And his family was really upset about that, but he did it, and he did it, and he died. And when we called the Chevra Kadisha, it was a big debate about what to put on the death certificate. And they're the ones that, the mortuary is the one that handles the death certificate. When they found out what happened, this is all new for us, basically. And this is all a couple of years ago, and it was brand new. The Chevra Kadisha said, wait a second. Turn to the handouts that I gave you. Look at the first page I gave you. That's the Aruch HaShulchan. This is really from the Gemara, but that's just a quote from it. I thought it was just that you did a nice summary. On the top of page one there, it says, Garcina Besmachos, the Gemara in Besmachos says, Hama'abed Atmo Ladas, one who, that's how you say suicide in rabbinic law, one who loses themselves, basically, but that's how they said suicide. Hama'abed Atmo Ladas, Ein Misasking Imo Bechol Davar. They do not, the Chevra Kadisha can have nothing to do with them, whether burying them in a Jewish cemetery, nothing. The Tahara, Tachrichin, can't have anything to do with them. So the Chevra Kadisha, an Orthodox Chevra Kadisha, said to us, I'm sorry, I don't think we can take the body. Which, as you can imagine, the family who's already in crisis because they've been trying to convince him not to do it, he did it anyways, now they're just beside themselves, and they at least want to have a funeral, and they're being told, not allowed. So we realized we had to deal with this because, first of all, we knew it wouldn't be the first one, and it hasn't been. We knew it wouldn't be the last one. It was the first one. We knew it wouldn't be the last, and it hasn't been the last. And we realized this. We have to be able. There must be a solution, or maybe there's not. What are we going to do? We didn't know. So look at, and just to strengthen the question. Look at just a few more. This Aruch HaShulchan is—he's simply quoting the Gemara, but I just thought he did a really nice job of summarizing. He says in Sif Bet there, he says Vishaninu Sham Ein Korin Alav Ein Chotin Alav. Right, you can't do Kriya even Chalitza Ein Maspidim Alav, even a Hesped, a funeral, eulogies of a Ondim Alav Bishur of a Omrim Alav Birchas Avim. You could say the Hamak Minachim to the family Nishu Kavod Achaim, because you can give respect to the living, but not to the dead. Then they have an interesting, in chapter 3, in paragraph 3 there, it defines suicide in halacha. How do you define suicide? Meaning, what category is a suicide and what's not? This is important. So he says there, Od Sheni Nusham, meaning we also learn there in the Gemara and Smachos and the Masechta Katana, Eze Hama'aved Atzmo Ladas. What is considered suicide? Lo She'ala L'Rosh Ha'ilan V'Nafal V'Meis. Not someone who goes to the top of a tree and falls and dies. Or Barosh Agag, on the top of a roof, enough of a mace, and falls and dies. Ella, it has to be someone who says as follows. Zesh Amar, someone who says, Harini Ola LaRosh Ilan. Everyone look, Harini Mukhan Mazuman, right? I'm going, I'm telling you all right now. Here's where I'm going. Here's what I'm going to do. They tell everyone, I'm going up there to the roof right now. Or the Rosh Hagag, on top of the roof, top of the tree. The Pilu Atzmi, and I'm gonna jump. The Amus, and die. The Roinoso, and then they see them do it. She'olav, enough of a mace. That person is Hareze Bechezkas Hama'abed Atzmo, Es Atzmo Bedas, Ve'im Esasim Imo. And that's the person that you cannot be involved with.
That mirrors the kind of language of the warning for somebody. You see somebody
yes.
being a murderer.
Hasra.
I mean, it seems like it's almost...
Yeah, they have to give themselves warning.
The same language.
Right. And now, this man in our hospital who did this, did he fit that category?
Yeah.
Okay, it wasn't on a rooftop. Sure. Yeah, that's right.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And I think there's something that needs to happen over here when it's out. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Are you taking questions now?
I think, yeah. I don't want to interrupt too much.
So it's okay.
There's a bunch of issues here that we're going to get into later.
We're going to talk about a lot, yeah.
A lot of them. One is your own discomfort, your own integrity as an Orthodox rabbi. Also, the issues whether, I mean, I know this Talmud case. I worked in a city where a rabbi died by suicide because he had ALS. He didn't want to. Okay. I'm just saying, was there a psychiatric evaluation done on this man?
Yeah.
To find out what the reasons were. Was it a deep depression? What was it? I mean, I had a patient who had... I'm not going to put it on the computer. Yeah, I'm not doing it on the
okay.
I'm just saying is, it's case by case by case.
Yeah.
You know
for
this,
sure.
Right? And there's situations where I will... There's a Mariam case, too. Why is the rabbi in the room agreeing with this? Even if you aren't agreeing with it, pastorally, you're navigating that uh-huh. line. But there's also your own integrity. Like Joe would say, I'm not going to agree to a terminal extubation because it compromises my own understanding of how people ought to die, uh-huh. period. I mean, I might get simple like that, but this is never one situation.
Sure.
It's always got its own unique
sure.
nuances. In the Talmud, no one sat down and said, maybe that person's clinically depressed. Let's find out what's going on in that tree.
We're
going
to talk about that, actually.
Right?
We're going to talk about that.
Okay, so I'm just saying, God, there are times where I have referred to other colleagues because I can't, in my own profession, I've done this a long time, feel comfortable in certain situations.
Yeah.
I cannot be a pastor, a chaplain.
100%.
Person.
Yeah, you sometimes, conscientious objection, you have to just ask to recuse yourself.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Totally. My point, see, the issue we had was... And we're going to talk about the issue of depression. In California, psychiatric evaluation is not required unless the doctor, and this is how it is in all of America, unless the doctor thinks that there's some reason why they're concerned and they have to order it. So they're encouraged to order one if they think it's necessary. This one, he actually did have. And they felt, you know what, he has capacity and he's made this decision. The reason why I bring this up is because, as we're going to talk about in a minute, we always have compassion for people who die by suicide. We always find ways to allow the burial. We find ways to show compassion and allow all these things. The problem is, in this case, it's hard. Usually we say, in fact, let's look at it. Oh, I'm going to save it for then because I want to build up to it. But the problem was... Normally we can say, you know, it doesn't exactly fit what the Talmud was looking for. There's reasons why we can attribute it to mental illness, mental health struggles, depression. But in this case, it was like, he kept on saying, I'm not depressed. I know what I'm doing. I know it's not allowed. And I'm doing it anyways. And that's why the Chevra Kedisha at first was like, how are we allowed to be involved with this burial?
Why not?
Right, don't embarrass the family. Right, yes. No, 100%. Right. And then I know there's a cemetery, I think it's in Cleveland I saw once, where they had a separate section for people that had died by suicide, and then actually the cemetery ended up expanding, and next thing you knew, they were right in the middle of the cemetery. It was like God's way of kind of embracing them later. But no, 100%, this is why it was a dilemma, because... Right. Right. No, you never want to embarrass the family. I agree. My point is, when we had this for the first time as a new case, all of a sudden we were stuck because you always find a way, someone who dies by suicide, that you can be allowed to bury them. This was the first time we thought, like, wait, all the reasons we used to use in the past can't be used here because we lost all of our excuses that we've had. So where do we have an excuse? And I'll show you in a second. Yeah.
Patient know that
they would have this moral dilemma.
Well, the patient know that by choosing this way of ending life, that they would be jeopardizing their ability to be buried in a Jewish cemetery.
It seems like he did, because he was just like, I know it's not allowed and I know it's going to bother you, but I'm doing it anyway. He didn't seem to care. He was knowledgeable enough that he probably was aware, even though I don't think he said it. I don't remember him saying it.
Sort of like, this speaks to the idea, can we do burial planning while you're still alive?
Right, that would have been a nice solution. That would have helped. So we were stuck. And this was one of those cases where we got stuck. And it needed to be solved right away. Because now we have a corpse, a mourning family, a community that's been informed that a funeral is going to be announced soon. Like, we have to figure it out. So we started searching. You know, I consulted some rabbis. They were like, we need to figure this out. This is new. This is new for us, right? When aid and dying became legal, when it was illegal, it was just different. It was never so blatant in this way. So I'll show you the sources that we relied on. There's a few rabbis in Los Angeles, some that I found, and also consulting with Rabbi Asher Weiss. First, there's a somewhat well-known, very tragic, and very powerful quote in the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef is Rav Yosef Cairo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, but he also wrote a commentary in the Tur where he summarizes his rulings, and there's a really, really interesting, so sad, but it's really the reality of Jewish history and also somewhat relevant maybe even for October 7th in Israel. Just a wild piece here. And we thought maybe this is our solution. He says as follows, the bottom of page one there. He's quoting the Orchos Chaim, a Kasuv Orchos Chaim, a Rishon, one of the medieval rabbinic authorities, who says, Veracious Rabba, it says in the Midrash, Veracious Rabba, V'doresh ve'ach estimchem l'nafshosechem edrosh. That's a verse in the Torah. But why does it say ach? It says ach estimchem l'nafshosechem edrosh. What's the word ach mean there? That usually means like but, right? But what is it doing in that sentence? I will demand accounting for your souls. But what does it mean? But I will demand accounting for your souls. So the Midrash there says, Azhara lechonik et nafsho. It's a warning for someone not to strangle themselves, is the literal translation. It's a warning against suicide. It says, I will demand accounting for your souls if you take your own soul. That's what it's saying. That's the prohibition against suicide. Afilu kechananya mishal v'azaria. It's even if it's in a case like Hananya, Mishael, and Azariah in the book of Daniel, when they were forced to bow down to this huge statue of Nebuchadnezzar, and they refused to do it, and they knew that that meant death, and they said, kill us, we're not going to bow down. They ended up not getting killed. But you would have thought, even like them, Talmud Lomar, ach. But it's another reason why it says ach, but Perush Shebishas Hashmad Yocholim Sarashman. In a case when the Jewish people is being persecuted, you could give your life if you had to. Lamisa Vulaharok Es Atzmo Im Hu Yarish Lo Yuchal Lamod Ben Yisrael. If you think you can't withstand the test, you could give your life in such a case. V'chein Yochol Afilu Kishaul Ben Kish. And maybe it's also allowing a situation like Shaul, King Saul, who did also kill himself, or his sword carrier helped him kill himself, but the Plishtim were attacking. He knew he was going to die, probably get tortured or somehow be abused, and therefore he did it. So maybe it's allowing just in those very unique cases and nothing else. She'im yarish shema yasa lo yisurin kashim. They're going to cause you horrible pain. She'yachol limsor atzmo lemisa tamalomar ach. That's why it says ach. Then look what he says here. This is the line here. This is just a crazy line here. He says, umikan mivi'in raya. And from here, some rabbis have brought proof for Hashochtim Hatinokos Beshas Hashmad. Those Jews who horribly, unfortunately, throughout history have had to kill their children to prevent them from being forcibly converted or from them being killed. Imagine they're hiding under a well or something and the kids are crying and they're covering their mouth. They're like, unfortunately, Letzareinu Harav, what happened in Israel on October 7th, people are hiding from terrorists and the baby starts crying. What do you do? And this opinion of the Orchos Chaim was that you would be allowed, we should never know of it, should be allowed to kill a child in order to prevent more people from being killed or from being forcibly converted. He would allow it in that case, the Orchos Chaim. That's his shita. So he says, Mivin Raya Hashochtim Tinokos Vishasishman. That allows people to kill children in a time of persecution. But Vyesh Osrim. But some said, no, 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 we don't agree with you. You can never do it. Umefarshim Hach, that word ach, they say no. That means Talmud Lomar, Ach She'enu Yachol Laharog Atzno Vechanani. And you can't kill yourself. Vechanani Mishal Nazariya Masur Atzim Biyad Acheir. They let someone else do it. That aval heim lo pagu ba'asim, they didn't hurt themselves. V'shal ben kish shlob ratzon chacham asu, and Shaul was wrong. The rabbis didn't agree. So that opinion was said no, he was wrong. Umay, and listen to this. Umaysa b'rav echad, and there was a story of one rabbi sheshachat tinokos harbe. He actually killed a lot of children to save them. In his opinion, as a rabbi, can you imagine horrible decisions? The horrible past we've had. You know, I sometimes joke. I can tell this joke among the chaplains. It's not a joke. It's horrible, but I sometimes joke, I have a master's degree in Jewish history, right? But I wanted to do something more uplifting, so I became a chaplain. That's my joke, right? Because Jewish history is so tragic, but that's our history, that's the reality, that's what we've had to overcome. So anyways, there was one rabbi who felt it was the right thing. Could you imagine your job as a rabbi? We believe our jobs as rabbis are to comfort people, to support them, to inspire them, to encourage them. There was a rabbi who felt that it was his job. Who's the judge to kill Jewish children to save them from being forcibly converted or being killed otherwise? So there was a story. He killed many children. Bishas Hashmad, in a time of persecution. Sheyire sheyavirum al hadas. He was afraid they're all going to be forcibly converted. Vayima rav acher. But there was another rabbi with him. There was two rabbis. They had a little machlokas. Vechas alav vekaru rotseach. And he got mad at him and said, "You're a murderer! How could you do this?" But he didn't listen. Amar Rav Amaneh, so the other rabbi said to him, "Im kedivarai, if I'm right," this is a horrible conversation, but he said, "If I'm right that you shouldn't be doing this, yihareg oso rav b'misa mishuna, you are going to end up dying a horrible death." That's what he told this other rabbi. He said, "I'm not going to kill you, but your death will be a horrible death, and that will be proving that I'm right. You shouldn't kill these kids." V'chein haya shetavshu goyim v'hayu poshtim oro v'nosim kol bein or v'abasar. I won't translate it. But that's what happened to him. So that is a wild source there. Now, I remember this source. Speaking of my master in Jewish history, I remember learning this. So my first thought was, I asked some of the rabbis in town, could we rely on this Or Chos Chaim that you're allowed to die in a case of horrible persecution, or kill a child in a case of, it's also great suffering, like Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, could you apply that to our case with this man? They said, no. They said, okay, it's okay to know that that opinion exists, but it's not strong enough. It's not direct enough of a proof. There was one other opinion. One of them said to me, here's an opinion, but I want you to run this by Rav Asher Weiss to see if he agrees. On page 2, this is, on the top of the page, Piskei Tshuva quotes, Besamim Rosh. The Besamim Rosh, written by the Rosh, right? The Rosh was a Rishon, right? The Besamim Rosh is a book attributed to the Rosh, who was a Rishon. But it's wild. It's almost all scholars believe it was a forgery. So it has no standing. But some rabbis quote it and assume it is real. This is a problem. So he says, he quotes here, Besamim Rosh, the book Besamim Rosh, Kasav, Biechad Chaser Lechem V'Chashuv Sheis. There was a person who was starving, had no livelihood, no food. They were suffering, right? They're really poor, impoverished. Shehalach bifnei shnayim, they went to two people. The Amar, ma'asti chayai, my life is horrible. I have such a hard life. I'm poor. I'm impoverished. I'm suffering. Va'abed atzmo, and he ended his life. De'eno nikra ma'abed atzmo ledas. That's not considered suicide in terms of the laws of suicide. Kol she'osekei mi ribui tzarosav dagos v'yisurim. If someone did it because of pain, worries, or suffering, or oni gamor, or even poverty, that's not considered avet asam azas. That's not suicide. That's his opinion. V'ayim b'sefer har evil anaf echad aser shepik pekalav ba'avakasav delav gushpanka derash chatim alav. However, the Russian is very clear. If someone's suffering, it could be even emotional suffering, it could be just poverty, that's enough of a reason to say that's not considered suicide. Halachically, do everything you can for them. However, it's not the Gushpanka the Rush. It's that it doesn't. The other said, "I don't think the Rush really wrote this. It's a forgery." So now we're stuck. We have a source that gets us out of this problem, but is it a real source? So the rabbi said, no, you can't really rely on this. So now I'm like, come on, we got to bury this guy. What's going to be? So Rav Asher Weiss told us, okay, there's another source. Number three, the Marsham. The Marsham, 19th century posek. Just look in the middle line there. Summarize it. He says, I'll call panim ledina. The halacha is, yafakivan ram de'im asa kein mipnei yisurim. If someone ends their life because of suffering, ukadoma eninu bechlam avidas nadas. It's not considered avidas nadas. Because it is, even though it's forbidden, it's like as if they think it's allowed. They're an omer mutter. To them it was allowed, so you could justify. And this is really summarized in back on page 1. Look in Sif Hey, paragraph 5. The Aruch Shulchan writes a very beautifully line here. He says, Klalo shel davar b'ma'abed asma ladas. The main principle is, when it comes to people who end their lives by suicide, Talinan bechol eze tlia kloshu. We rely on anything we can rely on to say it was not their fault, so to speak. They weren't doing it totally autonomously. Kagon litlos behira. Maybe they were afraid of something. Or betsar, or they're in pain. Or sheyatza midato, or they just kind of had gone out of their mind. Or shesavur hayesh eze mitzvah. Maybe they thought somehow it's a mitzvah. Liblili kashel be'averos acheres, so they wouldn't do other transgressions. Yikudos be'elu hadavarim bipnei shezeu be'emes davar rachuk she'adam yasin nevela kazum bedas kazuluk. I can't imagine someone would do this with a clear mind. And he says, Tzei lamad mi Shaul hatzadik. Look at what Shaul did. And Shaul was a tzadik, and he ended his life, and the rabbis justified it. So the point is, they're saying that whenever someone ends their life, we must assume there must be some horrible circumstance that they are going through, whether that's physical pain or emotional, existential pain. And clearly this man, who, even though he said, I know it's not allowed, but I'm doing it anyways, he didn't like, clearly he was going through, it was very hard for him to tell his family, I know you're going to suffer, but I need to do this. He was obviously suffering a lot. There's obviously, side point, there's a big difference between pain and suffering. Pain is physical, suffering is emotional, existential. He was in a lot of suffering. And so we said, you know, you can't imagine that he did it as a way of rebellion against the religion, and you have to be able to justify this. We spoke with a number of great rabbis, and they said, 100%, give him full burial rights. Don't hold it back. But for us, it was just like this shock of like, oh no, we didn't imagine this scenario. So I wanted to share with you, because I thought these sources are very relevant and can be useful in a lot of different cases. But now I want to move, just because time is limited, to another case. We're going to make our way through a couple different issues. And now let's move similarly, because I'll try to get more and more uplifting, so to speak. But, I mean, you're still going to stay kind of low here, but we'll make our way towards the end, at least trying to be uplifting. We'll make our way towards the future. October 7th in Israel. Just an issue that brought up. I mentioned on Shabbos, but I'll add a little. An issue that came up that I found out about when I was in Israel 2 weeks ago, and I went to meet with Rav Asher Weiss, the posek for Shaar Tzedek, and Rabbi Dr. Abraham Steinberg, the head ethicist for Shaar Tzedek, and really one of the great ethicists of the world. He said that he told me the following story that happened that has not been in the media, because they don't want it to be in the media. But here's what happened, unfortunately. It's horribly sad story. But and also a big Jewish law question, and I think we'll be able to relate to some issues. He said, okay, October 7th, we know what happened. Horrible, horrible day. October 8th, a number of those terrorists that infiltrated the Gaza border area in southern Israel on October 7th, who were injured but survived, the terrorists who were survived ended up in different Israeli hospitals. A number of them were at Shaar Tzedek Medical Center in Yerushalayim. And so now you have, which I know we have in hospitals all the time, but this is an extreme example, you have the perpetrator and the victims there in the hospital. And 200 nurses at Shaar Tzedek, 200 of their staff nurses wrote a letter to their CEO, a petition, that they refuse to care for the terrorists. We will not care for these terrorists. And the CEO now had a big dilemma, because that was a big portion of their nursing staff. What do we do? What's the right thing to do? And Shaar Tzedek is an Orthodox hospital. Technically, it's a hospital under Jewish law, auspices. I think there's four in Israel, and it's one of them that they follow Jewish law. They have a rabbi, and they're supposed to follow the directives of Jewish law. So he didn't know. What should we do? What's right? Should we should I tell them they have to treat them anyways? Or because in Israel they do. In Israel in general, they treat terrorists. Of course, it's always a complicated question if it's on the battlefield. If a terrorist is on the battlefield and they're bleeding and does a Hatzalah member, sometimes some rabbis say, you know, in that case, if they're still a threat to you, don't save them. Or maybe even make sure that they can't harm you more. Or triage cases in Israel, you know, what happens when they all come in at the same time? You don't have enough resources. You have to decide who to care for. So in Israel, the law is, the practice is, treat them all. They all get treatment. You get normal triage priorities, regardless of who's the perpetrator, who's the victim. Unless the one exception is if a victim is dying or possibly dying, you prioritize the victim over the perpetrator in that case. But if they're not dying, you actually prioritize the perpetrator if they need it more. So that's the practice. In Israel, terrorists routinely, they get regular treatment just like everyone else. But these nurses refused. So they asked their rabbi. He said, it's a hard question, a hard dilemma, you know, because it's like we do believe in the importance that we care for everyone. Everyone's in the image of God. Everyone deserves treatment. That's what the job in the hospital is to treat. You know, we had this a little bit, like I remember we had a doctor at our hospital, and someone later told me that this is also an episode of Grey's Anatomy. But this really happened, where the patient was coding, and they ripped open the shirt in order to resuscitate, and there was a swastika on the chest. And this was a Jewish doctor. And for a moment, she paused. Like, do I save his life? Of course she did. Of course she did. That's the job. You always save everyone's life. You don't start judging. You start judging, like, based on political preference. Oh, who did you vote for? Let me decide. Because I had some doctors in my hospital who were joking at certain times in American history. I won't get more specific, who said to me, like, I'm not treating someone who voted for that person. You know, like, so, like, but is that right? No one. No one. Everyone in healthcare says you treat everyone. You don't start making. And also, like, there's a role of the medical team, and then there's the role of the jury and the justice system. Like, our job is to treat people. You know, in COVID, some people are saying, like, oh, if someone didn't wear a mask or didn't get vaccinated, you shouldn't. But we don't say that. We say everyone deserves treatment. So they asked their rabbi, and the rabbi said, even in this case, you have to treat them. It was very emotional, especially it's emotional now, but imagine October 8th, it was right then, it was so fresh, they were so upset, they were so hurt. Imagine if probably a lot of them, Israel's a small country, a lot of them probably had friends or family who were murdered or injured. So they take it really personally. He said, you have to treat them. Obviously, it was hard to convince them. You know, in addition to the fact that every human being is, even if it's hard, even if they seem to have lived in a way that contradicted their Tzelem Elokim, every human being is in the image of God. We have to have that basic human dignity that everyone gets treated. But they had to be convinced. They needed to convince the nurses and the team, like, to really believe, like, why should you do this? So he said, you know, right now we have the moral high ground. In the world, we are under attack. We've been attacked, and we have support from America and other countries that say, you know, we support you. You have to defend yourselves. You were attacked. If we don't treat their patients, we lose the moral high ground. All of a sudden, what's better about us? And it looks really bad for us. And might we therefore lose the support of the international community, which we need that support if we're going to finish the job militarily in uprooting Hamas? So he said, we need you to help us keep the moral high ground, so to speak. Then Dr. Steinberg added to it that in addition to that, they have our hostages right now. They have Israelis. How's it going to look if we start mistreating their patients? What are they going to do to our hostages? Have them in mind too. Not to mention another issue, which was that Israel does not have as much intelligence in Gaza as they have like in other areas. And they've been getting a lot of intelligence information from some of these terrorists. If you can nurse them back to health, they can actually be very helpful to Israel. You can get intelligence from them. Well, hopefully it would be helpful. So they convinced them. They told them the reason. They had a Zoom call with all these nurses. They said, look, obviously we save all human beings. That's always our commitment in medicine. We save everyone. Everyone has human dignity. But we also have additional reasons now. Even though I know you say this is worse, we also need you even more now than normally. And they said, okay, we'll do it. But do we have to give them pain medications? They wanted them to suffer. The rabbi said, yes. You have to give them pain medications. Also for similar reasons. In addition, everyone's telling them Elokim, but also the same thing. You're going to make them suffer. Word will get out. Word will get out that you're torturing them in Israeli hospitals. That looks really bad. And you have to just I think I remember the words he said. You have to grit your teeth and just do your best. Like, even if you don't like it, just do your best, and then you'll go process afterwards and decompress or whatever. But it's a struggle. I thought that was a really interesting example, because it's, you know, the importance of like maintaining morality in the face of immorality, and the whole idea that the Jewish people have been victims of unbridled abuse of power throughout our history, and we can't do the same if we want to come out of this hole. You know, it reminded me of another issue. Just mention one more, and then I'll go to the final issue of the day and something more futuristic and fun. But so that was an important example, something that's being dealt with right now in Israel. Another somewhat similar issue that I found out that they're facing in Israel when I went was, we went one night, this group of rabbis, to the Shura Army Base. The Shura Army Base is a rabbinic army base, full of rabbis. Probably not the most threatening soul. No, I'm joking. But why do you need an army base of rabbis? Really, they're rabbis with beards, and you know, but they're soldiers. But they're not soldiers on the front lines. Normally, their job is partially to be chaplains and encourage people and support them and be with them and facilitate religious observance. They also, just make sure that, you know, there's kashrut supervision, things like that. They're giving out a tremendous amount of supplies there. When we came in, we saw, he showed us some boxes of 60,000 tzitzis. He said, these just came in because the last 60,000 already went out. And these are going to be going out. Like, we can't even keep stock of them. The soldiers want tzitzis. They had just gotten a donation of 20,000 Art Scroll Gemaras, the soft cover ones. And he said, also these, they're already going out. The soldiers are begging us for more Sidurim, Chumashim. They have a warehouse full of them. But the other thing we saw there was that, for me, at the hospital that I work at, when I first realized that COVID was bad, what made me realize how bad the pandemic was when our morgue overflowed and we had to have two full trucks of corpses behind our hospital full of corpses. And that was our first real wave. That was when I realized, okay, this is serious, because our morgue never overflowed before that. So I remember those two trucks. We even had a rotation of chapels. We would go there and say Tehillim in front of it because we felt like that's the least we could do. These, our bodies were stacked in there. When we walked into that base, I saw 10 of those trucks. And I knew right away what it was. Finally, I asked one of the soldiers, he's like, oh yeah, those are full of corpses. At one point, then they opened them up because they were just going through them, and the smell was overwhelming. Horrible. And that's what the rabbis are doing there, is identifying bodies. They're the Chevra Kedisha, and the bodies need to be identified. And so then they could be then buried. In fact, while we were there, we got word. Also, we saw some commotion. They told us, oh, 14 soldiers were just killed in Gaza. They said, you can't tell anyone yet. Because what happens is, we find out first, as we identify the bodies, then we inform the families, and then after that, it goes in the news. So usually when you hear about it, it's because the person died like a day or two ago. But they're in a rush to bury them because they want to give them proper burial. They want to give them quick burial. And it's so difficult, but so important. And so this rabbi tells us, he said, normally in Miluim, my job in the army was, I got called up once a year. My job was to kosher a base before Pesach. I would go blowtorch, you know, the kitchen, and that was my job in the army. Now, my job is to identify bodies, and these bodies are not whole bodies, as you know what happened. So it's horrible. He said, it's so bad that the army realized we need psychologists to talk to. And so at the end of every shift now, we have an hour blocked off that we each get a psychologist to talk to debrief with. He said, my first day of doing that, I sat down with the psychologist, the army psychologist, who's been through wars before, and we started talking. 10 minutes into our hour session, the psychologist broke down crying. And he said, I'm sorry, I can't handle this. This is too much. You have to find someone else. And he walked out. He said, the psychologist can't handle what we're dealing with. He was like, we're overwhelmed. He said, when you pray for the soldiers, and you pray for Israelis, and you say the Mishra Berach, and you say refuat ha-nefesh, refuat ha-guf, have us in mind for the refuat ha-nefesh part. Because we're struggling. It's so hard right now. I thought that was amazing. We talked about, you know, the importance of, just like during COVID, of having whatever, it's self-care, taking breaks, taking days off, finding ways to cope with this, because it's unfortunately not totally slowing down yet. We still have bodies coming in, and it's tragic. But those are just some of the issues that we found out that they're dealing with right now in Israel that I thought were somewhat connected and related to the world of medicine that I wanted to share with you, that's important to be aware of. One other issue that we'll end off with our last, and also have time for a discussion and conversation, but just one other new issue, and this is what I told you, it's cutting edge, it's the future, and it's next month. Really? Next month. It's here.
Miracle of Hanukkah?
Yeah. Hopefully we should have lots of miracles, Bezrat Hashem, next month. That would be nice. Okay. Here's the issue. Who has heard of CRISPR? Good. CRISPR. CRISPR gene editing.
Yeah.
So you know what's next month? So it's here. So CRISPR gene editing was discovered in 2012. I'll show you how fast it's developing, how rapidly, what it is. In 2012, there was a researcher named Jennifer Doudna at Cal Berkeley in California, who discovered that in nature, this is all using nature. In nature, we all know about antibodies now, right? Since it's COVID, we all became experts in epidemiology, right? And right now, we're all military strategists. And whenever somebody's in the news, we all become the world expert. But we did learn some things, right? We learned a lot more than we knew. I think we all know more about, you know, contagious illness now than we did before COVID. So we all know about antibodies, right? How our body reacts to illness and it develops antibodies to illnesses. But she discovered, and it had been discovered before, but she discovered how to harness that there are some bacteria in nature that the way they fight for viruses is that they learn its DNA when it attacks, and when it attacks again, instead of them being prepared to have the antibodies, they know how to change its DNA to make it no longer dangerous to that bacteria and to basically kill the virus through editing its DNA. There's certain bacteria knows how to edit the DNA of the viruses. So they realize that is incredible niflos habore, creations of Hashem, that there's this thing happening in nature where there's DNA being edited in nature. She thought, if we could harness this and edit people's DNA, could you imagine the possibilities? I mean, they're endless. Anything that's genetic could be changed. So any genetic illness could be eradicated. And anything that about humans that we want to change, we could fix. Whether that means we want to be taller or shorter or smarter or whatever. You could edit a person's DNA. And so she developed this in 2012. She got the Nobel Prize for this, I think in 2017. And in 2019, the first three CRISPR babies were born against the law. But just to show you how fast that was, how did that happen against the law? In China, there was one researcher who wanted to be famous. He didn't get accepted to her lab. Or something, or her conference, something like that. But he wanted to make a name for himself. So there's a lot of people with HIV in China, that there's a stigma against them, and they were concerned. And he put out an ad in the paper: if you are married and you and your wife or your husband have HIV, you and your partner have HIV, and you want to have children without HIV, come see me, and I can make sure your children won't have HIV. That's all I put in the ad. People came to see him. 300 people came. They're like, yeah, we want to know how to do this. And then he explained. Without going into the details, there are certain genetic markers in our DNA that without that marker, a person cannot get HIV. But we all have it. Almost everyone has it. But what if you could CRISPR a fetus, even before it's a fetus, a pre-embryo, to not have that genetic marker? Then it will be born without that genetic marker, and then it can't get HIV, even if its parents have HIV. So when he told this to these people, these 300 people, most of them were like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I don't want you to edit my baby's DNA. That's going too far. We're out. But three did. Three did it. And they were born. And then he hired a publicist to get the word out because he was so proud of himself. And they made a YouTube video about it. And then he got arrested and put in jail. And then those three kids who've been born, we don't even know where they are anymore. And here's the concern. And I'll get more specifics in a second. And why is this next month? Don't worry. We're getting there. So why is this a concern? I mean, actually, let's go to next month now because it'll help me explain the concerns and some of the ethical dilemmas and things we're going to have to be thinking about. What's next month? What I keep saying is coming. So there's two types of gene editing. There's two types. There's germline gene editing, which is what this researcher did to those babies to make sure that their germline, their DNA is changed. When they have children, their children will not have that genetic marker. They are changed human beings. And it will be inherited for generations forever in their germline. That's germline. That changes. If you create a person with night vision, let's say you want to create the perfect soldier. I mean, this is scary, but you can imagine countries want to do this. They'll create someone with night vision because there are some animals. It's in nature. You can find DNA to do that. You can create people who are very tall, have like reptile, bulletproof, you know, strong skin, super strength, abilities to jump, you know, all these kinds of things that makes them great soldiers. Imagine, you know, and their children, there's going to be a new species. You could do this. They, I mean, no one wants to do it. This is like considered to be totally unethical, except for that person who did it. But so that's germline. Then there's somatic. Somatic is much less invasive. Somatic is when you take someone who's already been born. They already have their DNA. And you do an intervention whereby you edit their DNA to help fix them, but it's just temporary. It's just changing their DNA now, but their germline has not been edited, has not been changed. So sickle cell anemia is a genetic mutation. And it's a horrible thing. People who have sickle cell anemia really suffer, and they have to get constant blood transfusions, and it's a very difficult way to live. And there was a lab that realized, that figured out, that they could cure sickle cell anemia through CRISPR. Now, I'll get to that. There's a lot to say, but so they realized they could cure sickle cell anemia through CRISPR. So they started doing research, and it all went very smoothly. And the patients were coming out healthy, except for one thing. They began to realize that the people whose DNA is edited through CRISPR to no longer have sickle cell anemia lost their immunity to malaria. They became susceptible to malaria. It turns out, we didn't know it, but the sickle cell anemia mutation also protects against malaria, which makes sense, by the way, because many people who suffer from sickle cell anemia are African, of African descent, and malaria is more common there. So you could see, but they realized, oh, we didn't know. Because we don't, you think that we know yet? We've barely mapped the whole genome. You think we know what all of our DNA does yet? And we don't know. So you change one aspect of our DNA, and you realize it has impacts on other areas of our DNA. So now this brings out about a big dilemma, because it's called off-target effects. Let's say, I joked before about, let's say I want to use CRISPR to become very smart. That would be great. You know, wouldn't it be great? I would love to be so smart. You remember everything. You know everything. Wouldn't it be wonderful? You just edit your DNA. You have perfect memory. Wouldn't it be good? No?
Remember everything?
Yeah, why not? Exactly. And in fact, Rav Sadia Gaon writes this already in the 10th century. Forgetfulness is a blessing also, right? You need to be able, the ability to move on. That's part of resilience, to be able to put things in the back of your mind, to forget about them. Like, how can, if the worst things that ever happened to you in your life were always on the forefront of your mind, as if they just happened, how could you live? So our bodies are tuned, so to speak, right? So this is a big problem, because, so the FDA has to decide, is it worth it? Now, it probably is worth it, because malaria is not so common in America, and even for those living in Africa, there's treatments now for malaria. So they might say, you know what, I'd rather get rid of the sickle cell anemia, which is a horrible thing to live with. I'll be susceptible to malaria, but I'll have medications available. And if I get sick, I'll take the medications. I'd rather that. That's a better life than sickle cell anemia. So they've solved it. They can do it. They've done it for hundreds of patients, or thousands of patients. It's up for FDA approval in December. So that will be the first CRISPR drug to actually be used on humans and large scale. And last week, that drug was passed by the British version of the FDA. It was already legalized there, and that's why we're fairly certain that the FDA is about to approve it. So this is why I'm saying this is the new frontier. It brings up so many ethical dilemmas, and I'll just tell you why I think it's important for us to think about, why I'm even mentioning this, and then I'll begin to conclude and open up for any conversation. Yeah. It's somatic, so their kids will still be susceptible. Their kids will not be removed from their genome. Mm-hmm. Right. Unless it became legal to do germline gene editing and they wanted to edit it out of their DNA. They could, if that was legal, they could do it. And if they were responsible enough to just say, we only want to edit our child, the sickle cell anemia. That, what would be wrong with it? If it's illegal for adults, why should it not be legal for fetuses, for embryos? But this is where you start to get into the really difficult questions. Because what should be allowed and what shouldn't be allowed? This, by the way, is an issue that we already have today. It already exists in PGD. PGD is a very similar technology. PGD is, once IVF became a common therapy in the late 70s, early 80s, once you have the possibility of taking a sperm and an egg in a lab and combining them, so they said, you know, people that have genetic illnesses in their families, why take the risk? Why play with some people called sexual roulette? This is what some people call it now. Why play this roulette and just see if your kids end up sick? Why not just do PGD, impregnate 5 or 6 embryos in the lab, and then you'll just figure out which ones are the healthy ones and keep those ones. Let's say someone has Tay-Sachs in their family. Discard the Tay-Sachs ones and keep the healthy ones. So, and that's permissible. That's allowed by halacha. Because it's even for those who would be concerned about any kind of like abortion type of thing where you're killing, because like in the Catholic Church for sure it's not allowed. Because his conception is considered birth. But the rabbis say, Hashofech dam ba'adam, ba'adam demo yishafech. One who kills another person, by another person should not be killed. But the rabbi said, no, wait, what's adam ba'adam? And they said, that's uber ba'yerech imo, that's a fetus in its mother. So they said, you can't kill that. But if it's out of the mother's womb, there's no concern about any kind of, in Judaism, abortion is often allowed, but what?
It's in a lab.
It's in a lab. So it's not in the womb. So it's therefore, the rabbi said, you would be allowed to do these things, but there was one limit. They said, you could do it for medical necessity, not cosmetic enhancement. So once they say, okay, we're trying to get rid of Tay-Sachs. Okay, pick the one without Tay-Sachs. But then what if the researcher says, okay, wait, we have 4 for you that don't have Tay-Sachs. Okay, I have 1 girl, 2 boys, you know, I have 1 that's going to be tall, 1 that's blonde, 1 with blue eyes. Which one do you want? At a certain point, especially, okay, it's one thing if you're already doing it, but especially someone says, you know, we don't have Tay-Sachs in my family, but I just want to make sure that my kids are tall because I want them to be basketball players. So we're going to, you know, something like that. Which, by the way, is not so far-fetched. You know, the Ball family in the NBA, right? Lonzo Ball, right? Their father, this was a guy in the NBA who played in the NBA. He didn't have a lot of success. He wanted his children to be NBA players, so he only dated women from the WNBA. Because he wanted to have the chances that his children would be able to be basketball. And 2 of them are in the NBA. No.
Ball.
Oh. Yeah, he's alive. Oh, interesting. But yeah. But so the rabbis did provide guidance for us because they said you could do it for medical necessity, but not for cosmetic enhancement. So that gives us a little bit of room, but it's not so simple. Because what's enhancement? I mean, what if someone's very, very short? Is being taller, is that enhancement or medical necessity? What if someone's very tall? What if someone lives in a place where it's important to be blonde and they want to be blonde? So is that considered to be, just to avoid stigma, is that enhancement or medical? I mean, what if it's to be smart in a place where, you know, they really want to be smart, but then everyone all of a sudden, only the rich people have smart kids because they could afford to do this CRISPR and no one else can afford it. You all of a sudden have designer babies and special classes and it causes actually more discrimination because, I mean, the concern, the off-target effects of this are endless and extremely concerning. The problem is we are not ready for this yet, right? Like this is, we're starting to mess with the genome. We didn't even know when we started curing sickle cell anemia that it was going to cause, that it was going to prevent the malaria immunity. We didn't know that that was a thing. So imagine bigger things. You say, oh, I want to cure depression. Let's find the genetic marker for depression. But there are some who theorize already that if you would take out if someone has a genetic marker for depression and you would remove that, that they would become extremely aggressive and violent. Right? There's some theories that it's the same side of the same DNA. Like, I'm not saying depression is a good thing, but it's like the alternative might be worse. It's like you don't know it from a DNA level, from a genetic level. Once you start playing with it, you start messing with the human genome. So how fast to advance? You know, some argue that we should really take it slowly and be really careful because we need to be judicious. Jennifer Doudna, I heard her give a speech on this once. She said, every time I speak, she goes to conferences around the world. She says, without fail, I finish my speech. It was about some technical scientific topic. And as I'm walking down from the podium, there's people lined up to meet with me. And they say to me, Dr. Doudna, such and such illness is genetic that my child suffers from. Is it possible? Is it in the realm of possibility that with CRISPR you could cure that? She says, yeah, that's genetic. We could. And they say, well, why don't you? Why don't you? My child is suffering every day and you could do it, but you don't? What kind of a person are you? Help save my child's life, my grandchildren, whatever, my future. Like, if you can, why don't you? And she has to respond, it's not so simple. Yes, I can, but we could unleash all sorts of damage in humanity. And they're like, but you're letting my child suffer. You're a horrible person. And she's like, I kind of feel bad. I agree, but we can't rush. So I'll close with a mashal that I read in a book And then I'll close, and then we'll open it for everyone in discussion. But I'll just close with a muscle. There's this great book that I read by an author named Toby Ord, a British ethicist. He's not Jewish. And the book was written in 2019. That's going to be relevant for what I'm going to say, which is, it's just incredible. It's a really good book. It's called The Precipice. I will feel a little bit bad if you listen to a rabbi speaking, the one book you buy is a non-Jewish book. So make sure if you buy that book, also buy some Torah book too. But I always feel bad because I quote some book like that. I'm like, oh, I read the best ethics book. And people are like, oh, I bought the book, rabbi. I'm like, did you also buy something Jewish? I'm like, oh, great. I mean, what kind of rabbi am I? No, I'm joking around. But it's a great book. It's a great, great book. The Precipice by Toby Ord. So he says, what are the three biggest existential threats to humanity, human survival? And he wrote this in 2019. Number one, pandemics. That's what he writes.
Oh my gosh.
Number two, not in order, just three. Number two, he says, climate change. Number three, AI.
Oh my
gosh. In 2019, he wrote that. He also has an appendix about nuclear war that might be. So anyways, in that book, I'm not going into those three things right now. That's just, it's just a very interesting book. In that book, he gives the following mashal, which I just thought, it made me think so much. And it also think about all of our role in society. He said, and again, he's not Jewish, but this is what he said. He said, human civilization is about 5,000 years old. That's what he writes. He says, but if you look at other species, okay, putting aside whether the Torah opinions about this, but here's what just the mashal is good. He says, if you look at other species, we could survive for over 1 million years as a species before we go extinct or whatever. That's his opinion. We could survive over 1 million years. So if we're at 5,000 out of 1 million, right, we're in prehistoric times still, right? We're prehistoric. They're going to laugh at us. You had to call someone on one of these? That's prehistoric. That's such a joke. Okay, that's probably in 5 years we're making fun of us. Not 1 million, but. So he says, in the life cycle of humanity, we are like, it's not the math doesn't work out, but it's similar to the adolescent phase. An adolescent is the point at which a human has, a person has the physical maturity to get into a lot of trouble, right? An adolescent could get pregnant, could hold a gun, could technically drive a car, even if it's not legal, right? They could get into all, they're starting to get big enough to really do damage. But they do not yet have the emotional maturity to deal with their physical maturity. Right? They don't think about consequences well enough. And they make mistakes. I mean, we all make mistakes, but especially adolescents. But what do we have for adolescents? We have parents. We have laws. We have teachers. We have police. Like, we have things to try to keep them out of trouble as best as we can. Right? So, but if we are now at that stage in the human development that we are like at the adolescent phase of our development, we are now powerful enough to do all kinds of horrific damage, whether that's with nuclear weapons or with gene editing. We could do so much damage, and yet we're not quite prepared for that, right? We're going to regret. We do things that we regret. So he says that one of the biggest needs in the world right now is for someone to be the adult in the room. And I think that we have a role to play in that, right? I mean, maybe not on the biggest political questions. We're not in politics, right? But in the terms of like the advance of science, we work in scientific institutions or we're involved with doctors and researchers. We're involved with the world of advancement. And just as clergy, as chaplains, there is a sort of a moral voice that we have. And I think there is a value in recognizing that like someone needs to be the adult in the room. We're not about enacting laws, but we can at least raise questions and pose concerns and try to be involved in that aspect of humanity because it's changing so fast. And with AI brings up questions, you know, AI is bringing up questions for us as chaplains. It's depersonalizing medicine, right? It's there's things that like our role might become much stronger. It's depersonalizing medical education. A lot of things, you know, a lot of doctors are also already reporting about medical schools focusing much less on physician-patient encounter. All these, you know, AI is changing a lot of in the world of medicine that it opens up the need for the human touch. A lot of areas where I think our role is really, really relevant. So it's the future, but like I said, it's next month. It's in like 2 weeks that it's up for approval, and that's just going to, some think it's going to open floodgates of, okay, once CRISPR, you know, especially mRNA was used in COVID vaccines, that's not CRISPR, that wasn't gene editing, but the technology is is how CRISPR is delivered to the cell. And so, like, people think that we're about to move into the CRISPR age and we should be ready for it. There's a great book. If you, you know, I'm going to give you a second one, but if you buy two non-Jewish books, you've got to buy two Torah books on Codebreaker, Jennifer Doudna, the story of Jennifer Doudna, how she discovered CRISPR. And it does a lot of talk about the ethics of it and what technology can do. And it's written for the layperson, but it's also deep. It's not like it's written as simplistically. So it's written so you don't have to be a scientist to understand it, but it's sophisticated work. So that's great if you want to be aware of this stuff. So a lot to talk about, a lot of big issues. May Hashem be with us as we have to make these decisions. May Hashem answer our prayers as we discussed this morning and be with us as we pray. Help us to guide people, other people, and help the entire world to get through very difficult challenges as with compassion, with wisdom, and with safety for us, for Klal Yisrael, for the entire world. And may you all be blessed.
Amen. Yeah.
If there's any questions or comments or alternate speeches, as they say. yes.
I'm just going to say thank you. Thank you very, very much. I got to hear on Shabbat as well. I was thinking about...
please wait for the mic before you talk.
I was thinking about how blessed I am that I work in a mission system where there actually is an ethics up there.
Uh-huh.
I happen to be a Catholic institution, yeah. But you got your PhD at Loyola. A lot of people I know who are Jewish are doing that,
yeah,
because they're so good at teaching ethics.
Right.
I think it's kind of this balance of remember where we came from as we face these things that are going to come up against. I mean, you're wearing two hats. You have the ethics hat and you have the rabbi chaplain hat, which is really great, right? Because you have the expertise. And I think you're going to have to write a bunch of response literature now as we follow all of this. Otherwise, it's going to get ahead of us. Do you see what I mean?
Right.
We've got to always remember there's ethics above all this. And say, wait a minute, slow down, let's look at this.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're going to get lost somewhere in all of this. So I would just say, you got some more books to write.
Yeah. And I've been trying to advocate for what we call, they call in bioethics, the precautionary principle, which just says, it's like yellow light. It's like, it's not saying no. Because when you just say no to everything, I think a lot of researchers are just like, okay, you're out of touch. So, you know, technology is moving forward. If you just say like, no, it's unethical. But if you say, slow down, let's be careful, let's not drive too fast, that we drive off the cliff, like trying to find a way to reason with people that why it's important to slow down, where to slow down. Yeah. Yeah. Point well taken.
And they'll listen to you because you wear those two hats. You know what I mean?
I hope so. I wish that was true. But all of us. Is not true. You're very kind. Thank you. Are there any other comments? Or yes.
Yeah, I just want to comment. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
You mentioned beautiful about the Gemara after the
Rebbe.
The Rebbe.
Yeah.
In tradition and also in food. But I would like to quote a beautiful article that the caregiver should not pray.
Right. Some rabbis say that even though you're allowed to pray for someone to die, if you're the direct caregiver or someone who will inherit from that person, it's not responsible then because you have something to gain. Right.
Number two, I have another question. What do you do with people on isolation and they want to put on stuff? How do you handle it?
Yeah, we had this throughout COVID. What if someone's in isolation, they want to put on tefillin? We actually have COVID tefillin. And those are our tefillin that we have extra pairs that we'll give to someone. And then once they're done, we let them air out and then we clean them gently and then save them for the next patient. But like we do.
Not forget COVID is over. What do you do now if someone wants to put tefillin and in isolation?
We let them. We have it processed with our epidemiology that we figured out how to clean tefillin safely, and we let them put on tefillin if they're
in isolation. Yeah, you can't mention it because
yeah, yeah, Minchas Yitzchak said that because of the emotional pain. Okay, because of the emotional pain that a person will have if someone puts on tefillin every day. Yeah, yeah. Uh huh. Right. Yeah.
By the way,
okay, thank you.
Thank you.
One quick comment and on the question of the famous Gemara of the Amos of the Rebbe and praying for someone to die. Rav Gedaliah Schwartz, who's well known to this group, he's spoken to this group before, told me personally, and I told others as well, that based on the Ran's pshat on that Gemara, it is absolutely mutter to a halacha psuka to pray for someone to die.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, Laser Hershowitz. So, I lost track a little bit when you were talking about the suicide. So, according to Halacha, there's no concept of suicide then?
No, no. There is a concept of suicide. Maybe I didn't say it right. The Halacha that you can't bury someone in a Jewish cemetery if they died by suicide or be involved with their Hever Kedisha, that we find a way around. I mean, we're tola on something. We say it wasn't done intentionally, meaning it wasn't done as an act of rebellion against religion. Rather, it was because someone was overwhelmed with their emotional, existential suffering, and therefore it's not considered to be like their fault. One, the Aruch HaShulchan, their quotes, which I didn't read just to save time, was that there's a story of a child that the Gemara gives. There's a child who, if he got bad grades in school, his father would beat him. And the Gemara actually says that one day he got bad grades, so he was afraid of his father beating him, so he ended his own life, this child. And the rabbi said, you see from that, that his father was not proper in what he did to him, but you also see from that, that it's not that kid's fault. We don't blame the kid, we blame the father in that case. So the point is, they said, we're still going to bury him, we're still going to give him all the rich rights because it wasn't his fault. So we still say there's such thing as suicide, but they're still allowed all the things that the Gemara said that they're not allowed to receive, as long as we can say it was somehow because of emotional suffering, which even in this case, where the person who said, I know it's wrong and I'm doing it anyways and I don't care, and the psychologist said I'm in full mind, even then we were able to find a way to say, you know, but he was existential suffering. Yeah.
Yeah. This kind of reminds me of that space where you believe two things at once.
Yeah.
So it's not that it's halachically mutter to commit suicide in all these cases.
Right.
It's just we're going to treat that case when it comes to burial.
Exactly. Exactly. Case. Yeah. Sorry if it wasn't clear. It's not saying that it's allowed. Right. It's just saying that they can be buried.
Right. Next.
Right. Yeah. Good. Thanks for clarifying.
Thanks. Like I said before, this has been really nourishing. Also, just to be with colleagues and to take a day off from the work and work together. It's a real treat. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, I don't know. I asked before about doing burial planning with these folks who are in that 15-day process. Because the question for me comes to mind of, who is the recipient of spiritual care at this moment? Is it the patient while they're alive? Is it the family? So to some degree, I think, I guess I wonder if there's room to say to this patient, we'll call him Joe. Mm-hmm. Sorry, no, we'll call him something else.
Chloe, yeah.
Chloe, how are you? Chloe, this is the way that you're ending your life will likely, Not for sure, but we'll likely start conversations in your community, you know this, about how exactly to effectuate your burial.
Yeah.
Because this is sort of a gray area, Chloe. Now that we've decided, rather, that we're very sure that you're not dying of depression, of anxiety, of these things. You are choosing this, and we want you to be in this conversation.
Right.
And so, certainly, a situation like that leaves, if Chloe says, yes, I know, and, you can, indigent burial or whatever, it leaves the family with a very difficult bereavement.
Right.
Or at least there's clarity on how that happened. So I think there's also a question of, integrity. How do I deal with that as a chaplain and a practitioner? But are you seeing, I guess, in cases like this, that what are the conversations like with the actual patient in terms of the full acknowledgement? You will be dead soon.
Right. It's an excellent point, and it's part of why I wanted to bring this up, because I realized in retrospect when it happened that we should have talked about this. We didn't anticipate the question. So it's as you realize these are questions, you're right. The importance of talking about it beforehand is very wise. In fact, it reminds me, and something that I wanted to bring up is when I was planning on saying anyways towards the end, I did want to share one other thing, which is that there's an organization called Amitai. A new organization. You can check out their website, amitai.org. Rabbi Shlomo Brody is the head of it, and I'm a consultant for them. I've been seeing the great work they're doing and working with them a little bit. And their website has an incredible array. We're putting more and more stuff on it, but of like resources for end-of-life decision-making, planning, Jewish medical ethics, and in particular, there's a new advanced directive that we created, and we're actually going to be doing a session. We just did one through the RCA. We're about to do one in December through NHAC.
It's called December 5th at 12 o'clock noon. If you remember, NHAC is free.
Yes.
Central?
Zoom?
Yes.
On Zoom?
I'm going to the plan, I should know.
Yes.
I'm just curious.
And it's called the T-Vote. It's on the Amitai website. It's a new advanced directive that we created, and I think, I mean, I'm biased, but I think it's one of the most thorough and carefully done advanced directive documents that I've ever seen. It's a Jewish advanced directive, but also facilitates these conversations. It asks questions to help people think through and have conversations. It's a really important document, a really important opportunity. And if you're going to buy some of the non-Jewish books that I mentioned, at least look at the Amitai website and download the T-Vote Jewish Advanced Healthcare Directive. It's an amazing resource and really a lot of good stuff there.
Can APC members get access so they can teach other people about it in their hospitals? Or do you have to pay?
Well, webinars for NHAC members, but let's talk about that.
And if you want to do an event through APC or something, I'm happy to.
APC members, I suppose we could send you the link. Maybe you can talk to me.
Yeah, you have the right person in the room right now. Okay, good. Brian just probably accepted. Yeah.
I'm going to try.
Presentation is thought provoking, very much so, and reaffirming as pastoral care providers, very much so.
Thank you.
I am surprised the medical profession does not have greater pushback on DNA manipulation, because what you described is Frankenstein meets Superman.
Right.
Without anticipating, well, what we don't know. We didn't know this would bring on blindness or deafness, retardation,
right,
or all kinds of things that haven't even been around long enough to know the possible end result. And it sounds like there's a going forward because of the good that it will do.
Yeah.
And I love the example of being our adolescents. That's exactly
what it is.
So, look what we can do with our car on a Saturday night with seven of our friends in there.
Yes.
And no anticipation of end results.
Exactly. There is, unfortunately, a culture in the world of science of innovation, of being the first to do something. It's a little scary. I mean, even Jennifer Doudna writes in her book, when this fellow in China first did this CRISPR, she said, we were all holding our breath because we were afraid of the backlash. But then she writes, but then the backlash didn't really come. And that was really interesting. And for a lot of people, they were like, oh, I guess maybe this is not going to be. But it's scary. I think if more people would know about it, maybe there would be more pushback. It's also still been a little bit under the radar. One of the things I like to point out always is that, you know, in life, in medicine, just because you can do something doesn't mean that you should. And we have to remind people of that. And I think there's a great example in the Torah, by the way, which is that the Gemara says that Chizkiyahu HaMelech was Gonez a Sefer Refuos. There was a book of healing that had all the cures in it. It could cure any illness. And he realized people weren't praying to Hashem anymore, to go back to this morning's session. People were not relying on Hashem because they had this book of healing. So he said, you know what? This is making the world a worse place. So even though you could cure illness, he got rid of it. And we lost it. And he said, it's better for humanity to have humility and rely on Hashem. Just because we can cure it doesn't mean that we should. And they got rid of the Sefer Refuos. But I don't know if everyone would be so wise or cautious in the world. You know, all it takes, by the way, if America says it's illegal, then all that's going to happen is someone's going to go to the Cayman Islands or something and do it there. So you have to allow it in some ways, but you have to find the right balance of saying, okay, we're going to allow innovation, but with very strict, restrictions. It's a very hard balance to figure out.
Yeah. Big challenge. We've seen the same thing happen with the AI.
Yeah, a lot of them.
This past weekend, where
the CEO was fired.
And now the CEO has now been picked up by Microsoft.
Right.
And the issue seems to be willingness to move forward or being more careful.
Right, yes. It's a big, big issue. With AI, the part of it, it got so popular in the world that everyone was like freaking out about it, so they had to like pull it back. But if it hadn't gotten that public scrutiny, nothing would have happened. Part of our role also in the hospitals is, you know, we share what we're seeing, what things need to be called out.
Chaplain.
chaplain. It's really a chaplain role in some ways, carefully, but there's that prophetic role and there's the pastoral role, and we're doing both in some ways. And maybe we're a little more pastoral, but there's room for the prophetic role. Yeah.